May it please the court, nothing in this court's decision in Rydell represented a change in Delaware tort law. In that decision, this court reaffirmed that Delaware follows the restatement of second in determining whether a duty exists. In particular, this court in Rydell quoted from section 302 of the restatement, which states, and I quote, "Anyone who does an affirmative act is under a duty to others to exercise the care of a reasonable man to protect them against an unreasonable risk." In quoting from this particular portion, this court was simply reaffirming almost 30 years of what it said in Delmarva versus Burroughs, where it stated, Delaware law measures duties in terms of reasonableness. One's duty is to act reasonably. This court went on to state in that case, stated differently, one's duty encompasses protecting against reasonably foreseen events, citing cases going back as far as the 1940s.
Mr. Crumpler, before you continue with the substance, tell us the purpose of the amended complaint. Were you trying to amend it so that you would fit the claim into a misfeasance theory or a nonfeasance theory?
Misfeasance theory, Your Honor. And in our original complaint, which is in the appendix, had misfeasance. I mean, we just simply wanted to be absolutely certain. Within 1 month of when we filed the complaint, we wanted no question whatsoever that this was a misfeasance case.
So, and the reason I ask that is that eliminates what we identified in Rydell as the obligation for nonfeasance to show a special relationship.
Absolutely.
So here, we're not looking for a relationship between the spouse and DuPont. We're looking for whether or not you've made specific allegations of affirmative conduct on the part of DuPont, and that should fit this claim into a misfeasance claim, even though the spouse in Rydell was not successful.
Yes. Okay. And the problem, and I take the blame. I realize the importance in terms of how one couches one's legal theory, that in the Rydell case, plaintiff below, and that was me, had simply been sloppy in terms of articulating what our legal theory was. And the court correctly did when they go back to say that we talked about failure to warn, we talked about omissions, and it was not clearly focused. This case, the complaint talks about DuPont's actions, DuPont's release.
I stop you there? Because it seems apparent that based on Rydell and what happened there, anyone would now be looking to state a claim in terms of misfeasance rather than nonfeasance, right? And my question really is this area of the law fluid enough so that you can take the same situation and call it one or the other as you wish?
Your Honor, the area of the law is not fluid. The law is very clear that if you do an affirmative act, you're responsible. And DuPont did an affirmative act, or ICI did an affirmative act in Rydell. I simply had not properly articulated it. And there is an obligation that one has to the lower court and to this court clearly articulate the reason. I don't view the Rydell case as saying that we couldn't have had a case against ICI if we had properly pled it, properly argued it.
Maybe I didn't make myself clear. The facts of this case very closely parallel the facts in Rydell, correct?
Yes and no.
Okay, I mean, but for general purposes, in Rydell, it was at least started out as a nonfeasance claim, and the court rejected it. And now we've got pretty much the same facts, and it's being labeled a misfeasance claim. And really what I'm asking is, can the same facts be both?
No, the same facts can't be both. And the problem that in the Rydell case is I simply hadn't focused on what the proper legal theory was. I mean,
I thought Rydell simply went off on the fact that the misfeasance articulation wasn't made to the trial court in the first
instance? That's absolutely. I did not. It was my failure. It's not that the facts changed. It was improper legal argument.
Let's state it a different way. And although we have two cases, each involving a spouse that washed their husband's clothes after exposure to the asbestos at work, and we know what the law is, what you're saying is, in Riedel, I didn't marshal the facts to fit into misfeasance.
That's correct.
Now, after Riedel, I'm on notice that if I want to pursue a claim for a spouse who washes clothes, I have to be able to allege with particularity some affirmative acts. And I've amended my complaint in this case, and I now think that I've corrected the deficiencies in Riedel, and I've set forth an amended complaint that should withstand a motion to dismiss on misfeasance.
That's correct, Your Honor. And let me just say, because I had been doing household exposure cases for 30 years, going back to Shoe Brooks, same complaint, we never really were worried about duty, was just always assumed. And so that is why that the pleadings were very sparse. We simply did not. The facts were the facts in terms of the companies released asbestos, got on the backs of people. It was basically an environmental discharge. But the problem, it's all very clear that the way I did the pleading in Riedel, and had done the pleading before, as I talked about, failure to warn, not doing something, when really there were additional facts, it was a discharge, but that had not been specifically pled clearly, as this court correctly said, and had certainly not been raised in summary judgment before the trial court below. In this case, and it's very important, we are just at the beginning of this case. We have alleged that DuPont has violated Delaware law within the terms of the restatement and affirmative act. Once there is an affirmative act, the duty is very clear under Delaware law. You have a duty to anyone that you injure. It's limited by foreseeability, but you have that. It's only in the case when you do not do an act, when it's an omission, that you get into the special relationship. And that's really where duty comes in, and there's a lot of discussion about
that. Is it correct that procedurally where we are is you move to amend your complaint to recharacterize the claim, and the opposition was on the basis that it would be futile to do so because all you're doing is recharacterizing the same facts that were in Riedel, and it doesn't really matter what you call it. It's still futile to amend the complaint because you're going to get nowhere.
That's essential.
And that's what's before us now, whether that motion to amend should have been denied. Is that correct?
Yes.
What's your understanding of the trial judge's holding when the trial judge decided to deny your motion to amend?
The trial judge, and quoted from her, she admitted that the holding in Riedel was very narrow, that it was simply I had not properly pled it, and because I had not pled misfeasance and argued it below, they didn't deal with misfeasance. But then she said that she thought this court was giving a roadmap and saying that even if I had done misfeasance, I still would have lost Riedel. That is how she interpreted it, that these facts, even if I had alleged misfeasance, I would have lost it. And all due respect to the trial judge, there's a lot of difference between what I've done here and what was in Riedel.
She also relied on the special master's report quite heavily, didn't she?
Yes, the special master's report was based on an earlier decision that she made in Foley, which came out. And after the Foley decision, we wanted to be absolutely clear. And that was a case, interesting enough, where she even found that Amoco, which is an asbestos manufacturing plant, was affirmatively releasing pollution, toxic asbestos, into the environment. And she said, I still don't view this court would hold that that's an actionable cause of action.
Well, tell us, why don't we just go right to the complaint, focus on the acts you've alleged by DuPont and that would withstand a motion to dismiss on a theory of misfeasance.
Your Honor, in the complaint at A36, this is the amended complaint, we talk first 11, the release by DuPont of fibers. And number 12, we talk about that the material is escaping beyond the borders of the facility. It is a result of DuPont's conduct in ordering the use of asbestos and how asbestos was used, releasing it into the air. Makes it very clear that the vector, Bobby Price, was an innocent person. It says, quote, did not understand the fibers were on his person or his clothing. This was the result of the willful and wanton method that DuPont required its employees and contractors to handle materials releasing asbestos fibers. That they released not only within the facility, which then was carried by the wind and also by individuals innocently out into the environment. There is nothing in there in terms of DuPont failed to warn, DuPont failed to do other things.
But in this case, all of the allegations for this spouse relate to the husband's clothes, don't they?
The husband's clothes in person, yes. But there is, I submit, no difference between if the spouse, if the plaintiff lived next to the plant and the wind carried the asbestos and she was exposed. And DuPont in their brief said that this court has recognized that DuPont would have liability for that environmental discharge. Well, there's no difference. DuPont used asbestos, released asbestos within the plant.
Well,
and because of that,
help us understand the relationship between the acts you attribute to DuPont and the concept of foreseeability as it results to your claim. And in particular, are you asking us to adopt the reasoning of the Tennessee Supreme Court? Do you think that, you know, where they talked about foreseeability being almost unlimited, but that was the way it should be?
Your Honor, the Tennessee Supreme Court, and I think it's the dissent talked about the restatement third. The majority opinion was very clear in terms of restatement second. The Tennessee court was really no different than the Delaware court in Delmarva, that once you do an affirmative act, and you injure someone, you create a relationship because you're the tortfeasor, you're liable. There can be a limitation because of foreseeability when it's a freak situation that you can deal that. And if you look in terms of the overwhelming majority of all cases that around the country that dealt with household exposure have at least allowed the possibility of it as long as it's foreseeable. Even those cases such as Michigan, which in the particular case, Kentucky, ruled against it, they said because you hadn't shown in terms of foreseeability. I think the Texas case that I recently sent to your honors shows very clearly that issue. There was an earlier case in Texas, Beringer, where the facts were such that the defendant didn't have reason to know that this person was within the zone of danger. DuPont, in the Ramsey case, did have reason to know. The state of the art was such was that it was foreseeable. So there is a limitation. We're not opening up Pandora's box by allowing here.
We may be revisiting old ground here, and you have to be patient with me. Well, I guess you don't have to, but you'll respond to the question.
I do, Your Honor.
This concept of foreseeability, that's a factual or legal issue. Where does the law say beyond this point, no rational person could consider the ambit of risk foreseeable?
Your Honor, foreseeability is a mixed question of law and fact.
Somehow I knew you were going to say that.
But judges all the time deal with that. Just in terms of the cases of stolen vehicles.
So it's a decision for the judge to make in the first instance?
Absolutely, absolutely. And we have stolen vehicles. There's a recent decision by Judge Cooch that said that, cited in the briefs, that it was not foreseeable in terms of the stolen vehicle. There have been other decisions would say it is foreseeable. There are some facts and circumstances. And judges serve as gatekeepers all the time. And certainly in this case, and all we are asking for is the opportunity
it's fair to say I'm concerned about just how open the door is going to be if we follow your reasoning to the logical extreme. Let's assume that there's a bus stop out in front of the DuPont plant, and every day people from that plant get on the bus, which includes people who don't work at the DuPont plant, and then a regular transit bus rider gets asbestosis, and there's a claim that it's because people from the DuPont plant get on that same bus and have done so for the last 300 and some odd work days.
Yeah.
Is that foreseeable?
Your Honor, that case would easily – no, it's not foreseeable. And that would easily lose on a motion for summary judgment.
Why is that not foreseeable? Well, if it's a bus stop in front of the plant, DuPont knows its workers use the bus. They know other people ride the same bus route going to and from work.
The reason, and I'd point out in terms of the Ramsey case, which talks about what is the knowledge that DuPont had. When you're dealing with risk, you're dealing with the gravity of the harm, the foreseeability. What is there in the state-of-the-art literature to show that bus drivers who happen to pick up somebody with clothes develop asbestosis? There's nothing. There has been no case. Household exposure, there have been cases since 1897. There are DuPont internal documents that recognize that risk. It is foreseeable by the facts of the particular case. DuPont could file a motion.
Why doesn't that then get characterized similarly with the special relationship situation? Special relationship between DuPont, its employees, and members of the employee's household.
A special relationship is something where that comes into effect when there is a failure to act. And it is governed by certain unique circumstances. When you act, it's a presumption in terms of that you are responsible. It is limited by the foreseeability in order so that it's not unlimited liability. And that is the check that we have. So, and quite frankly, we have done over 150 household exposure cases. Every single household exposure case has been household.
I don't want to take this to an illogical extreme, but let's assume that the DuPont company knows that people from its accounting department also get on that very same transit bus. And maybe DuPont even subsidizes the bus tickets so its employees can get to and from work. If one of the members of their accounting department was to contract asbestosis as a result of riding a bus on a regular basis with the employees who were exposed to asbestos on the job and left work in the work clothes that were exposed to asbestos fibers, would that be the kind of situation where it would be foreseeable that their employees and their employees' families would be covered under this concept of foreseeability?
If you can show that the accounting department had sufficient exposure to asbestos. And there have been cases in the Havig plant, we have how much use the asbestos is. There is literature in terms of within a plant, if they are sloppy in terms of the handling, you can get exposure.
But your answer is that basically on a case-by-case basis, the trial judge serves as a gatekeeper on the mixed question of law and fact or the foreseeability of the risk.
Yes, as it does in every tort case.
Okay.
Your Honor, I have 2 minutes left. I'd like to...
I'm sorry, we asked questions well into your rebuttal.
That's fine.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Jack Phillips on behalf of DuPont. May it please the Court. Your Honor, plaintiff requests a broad expansion of the common law in direct contravention to what this Court decided a year and a half ago in Riedel. In Riedel, this Court clearly recognized the nonfeasance-misfeasance distinction that exists in every jurisdiction in the United States to some degree. Nonfeasance is based on the common law principle that recognizes that someone removed from or distant from the action that is the primary cause of the alleged injury is not liable for that injury. Look at DuPont's conduct herein. It had an office building that also had clean laboratories in it that contained asbestos insulation like all other buildings of its time. It purchased that insulation from manufacturers who were directly involved in the purchase of raw asbestos and mixed that raw asbestos into asbestos-containing products that it then sold to DuPont, placed them in the stream of commerce with at least the implicit, if not the explicit, representation that the product was safe to use. All DuPont did was purchase that product, install it, and maintain it in the manner in which it was intended to be used. Stripped of its rhetoric, plaintiffs' new allegations are that DuPont caused Mr. Price to work with asbestos-containing materials but failed to properly control the safety and working conditions while he did so, and failed to warn or prevent the warn or prevent the danger to Mrs. Price. This is definitionally nonfeasance under Riddell. Plaintiff's efforts to distinguish this case from Riddell are nothing more than semantics, I think, as Justice Berger was getting at. They simply use new labels, but the underlying facts are identical to Riddell. Now, realizing Your Honor's statement, Chief Justice Steele, that there was an element to the Riddell opinion that said you didn't raise this issue below. But like Judge Johnston said, if that's all this court was going to do in Riddell, you could have stopped with a one-page order. You could have stopped with a two-page opinion. Instead, we got 12 pages. Those other 10 pages have to mean something. And what Judge Johnston said they mean is that you considered the underlying facts, and if you read the opinion, it's clear you considered the underlying facts. Those underlying facts...
Wait a second. Are you saying that in Riddell, the court decided that under facts similar to those in Riddell, there is no misfeasance claim?
Yes, Your Honor, that's what I'm saying.
Even though the court said we're not looking at that?
That's right. But if you...
So we said one thing but did another? Is that the way we should interpret that opinion?
My view of that opinion is, Your Honor, you said quite clearly that the plaintiff failed to raise this issue below. And that alone would have been enough for you to deny their appeal.
So your point is, if that were the holding of the case, we would have stopped there. So that you must be able to find the holding elsewhere. The rest, the other 10 pages, are not dicta?
That's my position, yes, Your Honor, that you could have stopped with, as I said, a one-page order, denied, failed to raise the issue below.
But you're really characterizing it as an alternative holding.
That's just where I was going in answer to Chief Justice Berger's question, Your Honor. That is that, you know, having stated that they failed to raise the issue below, this court went on to analyze what they were then asserting. And you quite clearly found that they had asserted misfeasance as to Mr. Riddell, but only nonfeasance as to Mrs. Riddell.
So how do you respond to Mr. Crumpler's contention that he learned from Riddell and that his amended complaint fits him into a misfeasance claim, even though the complaint in Riddell did not? In other words, you characterize this as repackaging the same facts. Mr. Crumpler saying, no, I've alleged different facts.
Yeah. Mr. Crumpler has alleged perhaps some additional facts that are still nonfeasant facts. So he may have clarified his position, but his position is still nonfeasance, definitionally, under Riddell. His extra facts don't get him where he needs to be. Is my point and my position.
So if we look at the recommendation of the special master in the Superior Court's decision, you characterize it as saying Riddell went on at length with what we're calling an alternative holding that said the spouse could not prevail on a claim for misfeasance, and the allegations in this amended complaint we have before us don't get around the problems that were identified in Riddell with a misfeasance claim by a spouse. Therefore, there's no need to permit the complaint to be amended because, as a matter of law, it doesn't state a cause of action.
That's correct, Your Honor. Just stating additional facts or more facts or hanging a different label on them doesn't change the underlying facts. And I think under Twombly, and this court has an opinion holding the same thing, that you have to look at the underlying facts. You can't simply look at the labels the plaintiff's counsel wants to put on it. And all they want to do is put a different label on the same facts. Mr. Crumpler can't point to a different fact didn't exist in Riddell that exists in this case.
Well, we understand the general argument, and at the risk of misstating Justice Holland's question, identify us for us the additional facts that you say still constitute misfeasance rather than or still constitute nonfeasance rather than misfeasance. Difficult to keep in the two straight in my own mind right now. Tell us what those additional facts were and why they do not properly claim the alternative.
Mr. Crumpler's, I think his additional facts are now that he tries to blur the distinction between an environmental release and what happened here. He tells you that they released fibers. Yes. They released fibers, if you believe them, if you accept their pleadings as the facts, they released fibers inside the facility. He then says they released fibers outside the facility onto their premises. All right? That Mrs. Price's claim is not based on a premises exposure. Mrs. Price's claim is not based on an environmental exposure. Mrs. Price's claim is based on an exposure to her husband's work clothes. There's not a court in this country that has ever held that an employee's work clothes are an environmental vector release. And that's what Mr. Crumpler has stated here this morning. He has tried to tell you that the work clothes are the same as an environmental release, and that is simply not the case. There's no court in this land that has held that.
All right, so, is there any court that has held that it isn't?
No, because nobody's made that foolish argument.
Well, all right, let's see how foolish it is.
Okay.
Be careful what you wish for.
Yes, yes. I might want to retract that statement.
Okay, if we talk about a release of some toxic substance,
yes,
and we assume that that happened,
okay,
and if the windows had been wide open and her house was 10 feet away from the wide open windows and this toxic substance kept the prevailing winds and all that stuff kept blowing into her house,
yes,
depositing some of the toxins in her house, resulting in her injury.
Yes.
That would be an act of misfeasance, would it not?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Why should there be a distinction if the toxic substance is released onto a person's clothing and that person walks across the street every day and gets into his house and all those toxins start spilling around the house? Why hasn't there been a release by DuPont that has resulted in an injury to the wife?
A couple points, Your Honor. First of all, in your example of the what I would call an environmental release, environmental releases have long been recognized under the common law. Second point is it depends, you know, some of that, your example may depend on specifically the material involved, because some of it could be ultra-hazardous activities. If your example in the Rydell argument was anthrax, which of course would be an ultra-hazardous substance. Mr. Crumpler's example in his briefs were radioactive materials. Again, you know, ultra-hazardous activities.
So wait a second. So there's a distinction between a release of very hazardous stuff and a release of not so hazardous stuff?
Well, the very hazardous stuff is strict liability.
All right.
All right. So that's an important distinction. But the intervening factor here in the clothing example is that you have this intervention of a third party, that is this human being who is carrying this material somewhere. The problem with Mr. Crumpler's argument is that he's asking this court to hold every landowner, not just industrial landowners, but commercial landowners and residential landowners, liable for any employee or subcontractor employee who leaves their premises and goes anywhere in the world with something on his clothing that might possibly harm somebody.
Well, you know, I understand the parade of horribles kind of thing, but foreseeability is a limitation on what the potential liability is, and although it may not be foreseeable that workers, whether they're subcontractors or permanent employees, it may not be foreseeable that they are going to get on buses, get on trains, you know, go for a walk in the city, and somehow people all around are going to claim that they've been injured by DuPont. On the other hand, it seems that it is pretty foreseeable that workers are going to go home every day. And if they're bringing home a toxic substance, then the people at home may very well be injured by it.
Well, again, just a couple points. The substance in question here is asbestos, and that has never been held, and has specifically been held not to be an ultra-hazardous material in Bell versus Celotex. Secondly, you realize that even under OSHA, there is a permissible exposure level that is not considered hazardous. Third, there's been no assertion of violation of that exposure level. Fourth, and that's even as to Mr. Price, directly outside the premises where this supposed release occurred. And certainly there's no measurement whatsoever as to what the, quote, level of release was inside the Price home.
But all of those are facts that would be developed or would prove you right in the end, but would not be relevant at this point, would they?
The problem you have, Your Honor, is that Mr. Crumpler wants to skip the duty analysis. He wants to avoid duty entirely. There still has to be some relationship. Even if you're talking about misfeasance, there still has to be some relationship. Not a special relationship. It may not have to have been pre-existing. But if you look at Judge Sleitz's opinion in Krasinski, you look at Judge Sleitz's opinion in the lower court in Rydell, he very carefully analyzed the idea of duty. And there is no duty owed to Mrs. Price, just as there is no duty owed to Mrs. Rydell. And that's what this court found in Rydell. And Mr. Crumpler wants to avoid all that and jump directly to what this court rejected in Rydell, and that is this court rejected the third restatement of torts because it changed the third restatement, in essence, does away with the duty analysis. And that's what was argued in the minority opinion in Satterfield, the Tennessee Supreme Court case. That judge said, look, you can't have it halfway. If you're going to interject foreseeability into this, then you are stepping on the finder of facts' toes. You have to establish the duty first. That's why that minority justice wanted to do away with any duty analysis whatsoever.
Well, how do we apply what you're saying to Justice Berger's hypothetical with the open window, where you know you have a toxic substance and will assume it's not one that would result in strict liability? So the toxic substance is just going out the window to the world, you know, where we have people going by on the sidewalk every day. Would you contend that there was no duty to the people walking by on the sidewalk?
Well, Your Honor, that has been analyzed under the common law as an environmental release. And that's different than what you have here. This is not an environmental release because Mr. Price or Mr. Rydell walks out of the premises with it on his clothing. And there is no way for us to know where that person is going. That person doesn't necessarily go home. That person could go down to the tavern.
Mr. Crumpler was telling us he's been litigating these household exposure cases for 30 years. Is that under a different theory, or are these last two cases we've seen just the first time someone has challenged his theory and before the point has simply been conceded?
It's the latter, Your Honor. I concede that these cases have been litigated for a long period of time in the Delaware asbestos litigation. However, not even Mr. Crumpler can point you to a decision where this duty issue was clearly raised and clearly ruled upon. And in fact, during the course of the Rydell argument, I think if you look at page 30 of the transcript, he concedes that that duty argument had never been raised and never been ruled upon. The closest he came to, and the closest any court has come to ruling on the duty issue, was in the Shoebrooks opinion. And that duty issue was only explored on the basis of privity. And the court found privity is not required. And that was the end of the duty analysis. Nobody until Rydell raised the issue of duty in the manner in which it's now before this court. And that explains all of these cases. Mr. Crumpler would have you speculate as to what this court was thinking when it passed judgment in the Mergenthaler case. Mr. Crumpler would have you infer from your own silence that you were approving the fact that duty existed. But that the issue wasn't raised. The case was decided on another point, just like Shoebrooks. This is the first time this issue of duty has been raised, and I believe this court decided this issue in Rydell, at least on these facts. I mean, the point here is that there is no reason why this court need go anywhere other than where it was in Rydell because the underlying facts are identical.
So, and then going full circle to and the legal issue presented here, the way you read Rydell is that in order to have a misfeasance claim, you have to be able to identify a duty. And the facts in this amended complaint don't do anything to address the issue of duty, and in the absence of a duty, the claim isn't going anywhere.
Exactly. Correct, Your Honor. And that's what Judge Johnston said. Judge Johnston said that Rydell does not foreclose the possibility of a take-home exposure case. But what it did do is, in facts that are identical to Rydell, it forecloses or makes it futile to think that no matter how many, you know, additional layers of facts you add on or assertions you make, the underlying facts are the same.
Well, but having said that, Mr. Crumpler's focus is on foreseeability, and your emphasis is on duty.
Yes, because...
And you're saying in the absence of foreseeability, since this isn't an environmental exposure case, we have to identify the duty.
Correct. Because, again, Mr. Crumpler wants to do away with the duty analysis. And if you do away with the duty analysis, then you cut the trial court out of being able to make a determination as to whether or not a duty exists between a personal injury plaintiff and any alleged tortfeasor, in this case, a landowner. And
so
if you go...
assume that Rydell does have alternative holdings, it's your position that the substantive alternative holding rather than the procedural alternative holding clearly said to prevail on misfeasance, you need to identify a duty.
Yes, Your Honor. Because, again, if you go to Mr. Crumpler's idea of foreseeability, it's always, you know, an after-the-fact analysis, but more importantly, it's only a determination that can be made by the trier of fact. So although he says it's a mixed question of law and fact, what that ends up being is a question for the trier of fact after all the evidence has been presented.
And as I understand it, in support of your interpretation of Rydell, you say if we hadn't been focusing on duty, we wouldn't have had to distance ourselves from the third restatement and stay with the second.
I'm not sure I understand, Justice Holland.
Well, we clearly said we weren't going to go to the most recent edition of the restatement because that edition, or you know, summary of where the law is, eliminated the duty.
Correct,
or the
Your
focus
Honor.
On the duty.
Yes.
So by distancing ourselves from the new restatement that eliminated the duty, it reinforces your position that Rydell thought a duty was significant.
Oh, absolutely, Your Honor. And that's in line with the way this Court has always approached tort law. That is, there has to be a duty. You have to find a duty. And what this Court said in Rydell was that, first, we're not going to the third restatement because it does away with duty. It would be contrary to what this jurisdiction has always done. And, you know, it goes only to foreseeability, and that's unlimited. It's interesting because you asked Mr. Crumpler today about the bus driver or the bus riders. When he argued in Rydell, he told you that those people would have a claim. Today, because he knows that he's on, you know, tenuous ground, he wants to say, well, no, maybe, no, not that's not foreseeable. Well, if you look back at his Rydell argument, he told you that the exposure to the bus driver was foreseeable and that that would be a basis for liability.
Thank you, Mr. Phillips.
Thank you, Your Honor.
This Court has spoken very clear in terms of when a duty exists. Restatement 4, if an actor acts at all, he must exercise reasonable care to make his acts safe for others. That's comment B of Section 4, which was cited in the Rydell case. If there's acts, there is a duty. That duty then is limited by foreseeability. If there's no act, you have to go to a special relationship. That is simple Delaware law, and that has been Delaware law for several generations. This is an off-site release. Again, Mr. Phillips is talking about labels, saying, well, no one's ever called it environmental. It is. It's not a work. It's not a premises exposure. It's an off-site exposure. The only difference between Justice Berger's example and what happened here is the vector. DuPont, they release it. They do an affirmative act. They sloppily use asbestos, and those are the facts here that the court has to take, not what Mr. Phillips has talked about, because those are not in the record. They release it improperly, and then it is carried off the premises. It could be by wind, it could be by a stream, or it could be on the backs of an innocent person. And again, the allegations here is not a third party that went and stole the asbestos. This is an innocent person on his back. With regard to Justice Holland, in terms of the whole question, for 150 cases, for over 30 years we've been litigating cases, including the McMurray case, and Mr. Phillips was absolutely correct. No one, until all of a sudden, even raised the whole question of duty, because it was assumed because of the acts. And we went to trial, and some of these cases got sorted out because we couldn't prove the case, because we couldn't show foreseeability, we couldn't show causation, we couldn't show that there was actual exposure. It's fairly difficult to prove that you were exposed. You could get a bus driver who could get sick, but he'd have many other exposures. Mrs. Price's only exposure is here.
Thank you.
Sorry. I see I'm out of time.
You're
thank you very
time,
much.
Counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.